listening to BCFM 93.2 FM. Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and coming up in the next hour, my guests and I will be taking a somewhat nostalgic look back at Bristol's transport. We'll be asking why is it such a mess now, and who is looking after the best of the old. Our economics correspondent Martin Summers is here to give his perspective on, amongst other things, whether or not the worst of the slump is really over. And our reporter Quentin Masseron is reporting on the French. He will be out and about talking to people in the city centre in Bristol about transport and finding out what you think about it. And to wrap up the show, Colin Power, we hope, will be here to tell us about his attempts as a layman to navigate his way through Britain's legal system. Anyway, to begin with, I'm joined by ex-boffin at London's New Economics Foundation and at Bristol Debt Advice Centre, Martin Summers, to give us what we like to think of as a community-friendly view of some of his some of the points on this week's news. Hi, Martin.
Hello there.
Hi. Anyway, financial commentators are now saying that the worst of the slump is over. The slump's bottomed out. Do you think we can trust these people?
Well, it's very difficult to make a comment on this. You've got to remember that if you're a central banker or a government minister or anybody in a position of authority, it's your job to say that things are getting better because you shouldn't be undermining confidence. So that means that it's very hard for the person outside of the loop, as it were, to trust governments when they say things are getting better, because that's what they've got to say. I mean, that's part of their job. What's clearly happening is that the stock market has rallied a bit over the last few weeks, but of course the economic news in terms of unemployment figures and things like that continues to be pretty dire. So there's a bit of a mystery as to why the stock market should be up a bit, but that's largely to do with quantitative easing and all the money that's been chucked at it, but it doesn't really fundamentally change anything.
Yeah, but surely if the stock market's starting to look a bit more buoyant again, that means things are moving more quickly and more efficiently, and surely this is wealth being produced by industry and by the financial sector in the way that it should be.
Well, no, I mean, that's obviously the point, is that what's happening in the stock market bears no relation to actual investment in the real economy. And you've got to remember that after the 1929 crash, the stock market only came back to the Dow Jones, only came back to the same level it was in 1929 in 1953. So if you've got a genuine recovery, the stock market is often the last thing to recover. So what we're seeing here is a kind of sugar rush bounce because of all the government money that's been chucked at the stock market. That money that has actually done something to stabilise the stock market, but of course all that money is the money that should be going into the real economy, which is crashing.
Well, I mean, aren't the two really the same thing? Surely if you're putting money into these financial institutions, that immediately has an effect. It's being lent out and it's being it's being spent into the economy.
Yeah, but the point is that you could cut out the middleman, as it were, and spend the money directly into the economy, which, of course, would be a much more sensible strategy, in my view. What they're trying to do is to preserve the existing financial setup with government subventions. And, of course, in my view, what they should do is just say that's a busted flush. That's just a no good way to run things. What they're effectively saying to people out there who are struggling is, go and get into more debt and then we'll get back to where we were 2 years ago. And of course getting into debt is exactly the problem. So all they're trying to do is restart the party, get everybody drunk again, as it were. And they need to rethink completely the way in which investment's carried out in the society as a whole. I mean, it makes a lot more sense if you're going to use the government to restart the economy, to actually the government to economy restart rather than government to banks to economy to restart.
Yeah, but I mean, I can't see a root and branch reorganisation of the whole financial sector on the horizon, can you?
I can, because it's going to collapse anyway. After this money's run out, the money they've spent has run out, then the stock market will go down again. And then the same question will then arise. Big changes in the way things were organised only ever happen when people get up off their backsides and make a fuss. And it was only 5 or 6 years into the great slump that the politicians finally got their act together and started doing the right thing, because people were banging on their doors saying, get the right thing done. And I'm afraid it really is up to ordinary people to demand that things are done properly. And if they don't do that, then they'll carry on in the same old way. There is an inertia in anything, and it'll carry on being done in the same old way until people demand a better deal.
Now, from the theory onto the personalities, Gordon Brown, it does look like he's coming under quite a lot of pressure. He's kind of turned into this sort of Billy Bunter character, who seems to be the butt of everybody's jokes this week, the last few weeks. I mean, do you think he's really, you know, we did mention this briefly last week, but, I mean, do you think he's being targeted, or is the criticism justified?
Well, I mean, he's obviously being targeted, but of course, if you're the Prime Minister, you can expect that to happen. I mean, the buck stops with you. The overall policies that he's pursuing, some of which I believe are wrong, is one issue. But of course, he's just not been listening to, you know, he just doesn't listen to advice, and he makes silly decisions. I mean, just a simple, small thing, but it's a bit rather indicative. He was in a school this week, and he was photographed in front of a swastika. Now, that shouldn't mean anything. It's not that important. It's only a coincidence. But, you know, somebody with a bit who's a bit sharper and a bit more on the case wouldn't have allowed that to happen. And I think what Labour MPs are beginning to wonder, is he accident prone? Because he does seem to be accident prone. And that's a shame for him. And, of course, what I'd really like to say about all of this is we really ought to be concentrating on the fact that the economy is collapsing, not whether Gordon Brown is good at telling jokes or not.
Now, let's just look abroad, because there's been quite a lot happening in Pakistan the last week, and another quite nasty attack. The Americans, it seems, the US forces are now just able to bomb indiscriminately in the country.
Well, what can I say? I mean, it's obviously extremely tense, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan.
Because who are the players in this power struggle? Because we had a kind of, I mean, what people would call a benevolent dictator, Musharraf, who was then removed by from pressure from the US and internally. I mean, is it a failed state, Pakistan?
Well, this term failed state is very much a real rich and civilized, and these people are failed states. Pakistan is in a very difficult position. Economically, it's in a very difficult position. It's very heavily in debt. Virtually all the taxes collected in Pakistan go to pay that debt, so they don't get used to doing anything useful for the people. We've got all of these geopolitical forces coming at work, you know, the sort of struggles between the Russians, the Americans, the Indians. It's a very, very tricky situation. But you have got a democratically elected government in Pakistan. And I think it behoves Western politicians to support that government and not lecture them about what they should and shouldn't be doing. They've got a very difficult job. They've just come to power after years of military dictatorship. And they need to be allowed to solve their own problems without being constantly put under pressure. I think a lot of the talk of the Taliban getting hold of nuclear weapons and all the rest of it is overdone, vastly overdone. The vast majority of Pakistanis are not militant Islamists. They're quite secular. And they run the Pakistan People's Party won the election. And there's no reason why they can't sort their problems out, given a chance. But of course, there's a lot of hysteria about all of this. And Pakistan is being put under a lot of pressure. I think it's going to backfire.
The Americans are saying, weren't they, that they're helping out the democratic government of Pakistan by sorting out, in inverted commas, sorting out the Taliban.
Yeah, but what they're doing is they're saying the Pakistani democratic government has said, will you please stop burning the borders? And it makes us happens if you're in your pocket and you're actually killing lots of innocent civilians. I mean, it's not, when we've heard earlier on the news that 400 soldiers were killed in Afghanistan yesterday, the other news, which was not, which we don't hear on the mainstream media, is 100 civilians were killed this week in an airstrike by the United States Air Force. Now, if we're getting totally unbalanced coverage of all this, certainly the British coverage is, when a British soldier dies, it's on our news. All the other deaths and destruction, we never hear about. And we've got to, if our soldiers are going to stay in Afghanistan, we need a full picture of what's going on. Yeah? More civilians are dying all the time. Now, what I would suggest everybody needs to do here is de-escalate this. Yeah? There's got to be an exit strategy from Afghanistan. The Afghans are going to have to run their own country their own way. And the same is true of Pakistan. And of course there are problems. Of course the Taliban have got some attitudes and so on that we might not approve of. But they do have some popular support as well, and they're going to have to be integrated somehow, one way or another, through some kind of peace deal in the end. And you might as well start looking for it now, instead of waiting another 10 years and with all the death and destruction that that will imply.
Thanks, Martin, and we'll be talking to you again about transport later in the show. Well, Bristol's roads are some of the most overcrowded in the country, which is why a congestion charge, much like that in force in London, is being considered for our city. But will this just widen the gap between rich and poor? Are the streets of Bristol for the wealthy and those on expense accounts? Something that should be a simple exercise, such as finding a parking space, can be a frustrating, expensive chore, especially if you come back from getting change from the parking meter to find your car has been hijacked for a king's ransom. But it was not always thus. Many can still remember the days when our suburban streets were almost entirely free of parked cars. Trams, trains, buses and cabs were how people got around, and we're not talking about that long ago either. At the end of the Second World War, Attlee's Labour government organised public transport and the road haulage industry. The British Transport Commission, which ran it all, also made films, which were lent out for free. And this is an extract from one made in 1951 called Work in Progress.
Our problem is moving people, especially people in a hurry. Bristol, seaport, university town, industrial centre, whatever you care to call it, it's crowded and full of people on the move. People who have to queue for the bus and don't like it. People who are irritated by the experiences that make every town dweller, sometime or other, want to live in the country. Some people even go so far as this.
Dear sir, I really must draw your attention to the disgraceful bus service on the number 22 route.
Last Tuesday evening, I had to wait at least 20 minutes for a 22 bus at Temple Meads, etc., etc. Right, Garrett, I want you to investigate this complaint.
Right, sir.
Heath, I want you to do a 4-hour check at Old Market. We need to analyse the loading there before we work out our winter schedule. Yes, sir. Brown and Pope?
Yes, sir.
I want you to check the loading at Victoria Rooms and then out to the aircraft works at 5 o'clock.
Very good, sir.
In Bristol, the bus traffic office will not admit defeat by the inevitable congestion of a city that's grown too crowded. To improve matters, it's essential to find out the actual performance of the services from hour to hour. The bus observers are the fact finders of the system, expert in detecting and recording the facts that reveal the weak places in the service. It's largely their work that enables us to deal with this kind of criticism from the public and adjust the service for the best advantage. The public must be served at slack times as well as at busy ones, and it's not always easy to do both. Even then, the delays and hold-ups of city traffic can make a good-looking schedule look like no schedule at all. But when the pile-ups and the gaps have been checked and located, then something can be done about them. Big factories, the aircraft and tobacco and chocolate works that surround Bristol all have to be served, with their thousands of people knocking off at the same time, wanting to get to all parts of the city. Elaborate arrangements are made with the works committees to get them away quickly. People with an allotment to dig, or a game of darts to play, or maybe just a home to go to. It looks like chaos sometimes, but in fact, careful analysis has made the scheme work pretty smoothly. Smoothly enough to move 6,000 people from one factory in 20 minutes. But in bus work, nothing ever pans out quite as it ought to. So there's always a relief crew to deal with the unexpected snag. They have the consolation of sitting in the canteen with the off-duty men. But they never know where they're going or when the bus will be needed.
Sir, it's very heavy on the three, sir. Can we have relief?
Not very well.
Here we go.
Smith, driver Smith, conductor Gregory, get the bus ready for Whitchurch, will you?
Cities grow, but not the thoroughfares that serve them. Watchfulness and care can do much to ease the flow of traffic and meet the needs of those who depend on public transport.
Yeah, so that was a short extract from a British Transport Commission film, Work in Progress, made in 1951. So what do Bristolians think of transport in the city today? Our reporter Quentin Masseron and Marina Morris, too, went out into the Bristol streets earlier this week to find out.
You know, they've put in
just
place
the park and ride, it's fine, yeah. It's reliable and, yeah, I think it's, yeah, money-wise, it's...
Regional transport? It's rubbish.
Why rubbish?
Well, it's far too expensive, and the city is so badly congested that the traffic doesn't move freely enough. Even with the local bus routes. If you're talking about bus routes, you know, they've put in place these new Wizzo bus routes, but they just don't work. There's just too much traffic for them. People park in the bus lanes.
It's overpriced and doesn't encourage any of us to use it. So,
do you take buses?
Very, very rarely. Can't afford them. They're too expensive, seriously. You can't rely on the times. They're not particularly good timekeepers.
They are very, very expensive, and they don't run to time. I usually get the X39, which is probably one of the better services, but, you know, the amount of time you stand on the bus stop for half an hour or more with a bus that's supposed to run every 12 minutes is...
I would use them more if they were less expensive, and perhaps the congestion would allow the buses to run better times. If they address the congestion and make the cost of using the buses cheaper, I think that would... Help in the overall problem. We regularly go down to the coast, and first is a bus service down near Portland, and it's an excellent service, quite inexpensive, and it's well used. Well, the costs in Bristol are exorbitant by comparison, so I think Bristol's costs are probably the most expensive in the country, and I include London there. So you can use underground service in London. We haven't got that service in Bristol. First bus are exploiting the public, and that's the opinion of the public. At the end of the day, first bus are already given large sums of money, to my knowledge, by the local authority anyway. And they quite often run inefficient services and aren't value for money. I think they need to give better value and encourage the public to use them. That way they will get more money by actually giving a good service.
I sometimes take the train from Clifton down to Temple Meads, and that's a very good service, and that's improved recently, which is better. But because I live up there, I take the number 8 and 9 bus sometimes, and I've lived here about 15 years and I've never understood the route, and I'm completely confused, and I'm not the only person, and it goes in a big long loop. So it would be better if it went more direct to where I want to go. I think the bus ticket prices are atrocious, really expensive. And one of the reasons I would want to walk anyway. I live up in Cottam. I walked here today. I wouldn't dream of getting a bus. It takes longer. You sit in the traffic and it's very expensive. I came to Bristol in 1983 and they were talking about having a tram system then. Why haven't we got a tram system that could integrate with all the other bits of transport? When I was at school 20 years ago, I lived in Newcastle upon Tyne and I went on the tram to work. And that tram goes to Sunderland, goes to the airport now, and it's all integrated to the buses. And that's what we need in Bristol.
It's too expensive, there's a monopoly, and the whole point about deregulation and privatisation, there'd be competition and that would drive up service and drive down costs. In fact, you have a monopoly, so what you get is they've got no competition, they charge what they want, they provide generally quite a poor service.
It's never been any better for years, and it seems to be getting worse and worse.
What do you think of the idea of subsidising bus transport from the council tax?
Well, it doesn't matter as well, because we pay council tax and we don't seem to be getting anything for it. We're paying more and more every time, and we're just not seeing anything for it. So that's what take it out of that, I suppose.
It's very regular.
Number one.
Yeah, and it goes all the way up to Cribbs Causeway and Temple Meads, so you can go one route all the way everywhere.
Are you satisfied with the prices?
They're a little bit high. The trains are okay.
My name's David Henshaw.
Sorry about that. Anyway, That was our reporter Quentin Marceron and Marina Morris there. They were canvassing present-day opinion about the way we get around on the streets of Bristol. In the 1950s, the trams were scrapped. In the 1960s, much of the railway network was closed by Dr. Peaching. And in the 1980s and 90s, bus and train travel was privatised. David Henshaw is a transport writer who now lives and works in Castle Carey in Somerset. He believes the state of transport in cities such as ours owes more to bad decision-making, really, than market forces.
And in 1991, I think, I wrote a book called The Great Railway Conspiracy about the Beeching era and the railway closures of that time. And since then, I've started a magazine called A to B, and more recently a second magazine called Miniature Railway, and that's what I do now.
Why do you think we're in a situation now where public transport is actually much less affordable than it was back in what many people see as its heyday after nationalisation in the 50s and 60s?
Well, I have to put most of the blame on privatisation. I mean, there's no doubt at all that the fares have increased. And although the government often tells us how many new cheap fares there are, the restrictions on them are so severe that if you want to turn up and go, you're now paying a great deal more than you were under the nationalised railway system.
What would you like to see done to make more people use the train?
Well, undoubtedly fares should be less. And if you talk to anyone in Europe, they say, your fares are outrageously expensive compared to most countries in Europe. Most countries in the world, in fact. So fares should certainly be less, and they should be simplified. Everybody wants the fares to be simplified, and although they've apparently done this, it's really made no difference.
So why are the fares so expensive, and why so complex?
Well, I think the complexity is to do with the whole, you go back to the fundamentals of the system, which are the railways are operated by private companies who want to make profit, and they're making no secret of that. That's why they're in it. And complex fares, individual fares for each railway company, means that they can squeeze the last bit of money out of the passenger, and that's what's happening. So we end up with a great plethora of fares for different routes and for different railway companies, and it's a way of getting more money out of the passenger.
But, I mean, privatisation was done because the railway wasn't paying, so surely this is essential, really, if the railway's to survive.
Well, if you go back to British Rail Days, just before privatisation, the railways were costing the state, in terms of all sorts of funding, just under £1 billion a year. They're now costing the best part of £7 billion a year. So how anyone can possibly claim that the privatised system is more efficient in any sense, it's beyond belief.
So the main change that's happened, I mean, there's two really, I suppose. One is the cuts in the 1950s and 60s into the railway network, and the other is privatisation. Why do you think that the cuts were necessary?
Well, there's no doubt that some cuts were necessary, and cuts were made to railways in most countries in the world, but they were done differently in other places. And my premise in the book was that the cuts in Britain went much too far. Something like a third of the network was closed. I would say at least half of that shouldn't have closed. And in fact, a fair number of lines have since reopened and been very successful. So if you need evidence that they shouldn't have closed, the fact that they've since reopened is all we need to see.
Okay, and what about privatisation? I mean, what would you think was the motive behind that?
Well, I think there's no doubt the way they did it, that they were expecting the railway to continue to contract, and they were rather hoping that the small lines and the small operators would disappear, and that's really why they did it in the peculiar way they did. They were proved wrong. Now, the supporters of privatisation say the increase in passengers is down to privatisation, but those of us who don't believe that's the case would say it's simply because the demand for transport has increased, generally speaking. So, and of course, road congestion has done a great deal of good for the railways. So lines that were quiet 20 years ago are now overflowing at the seams.
So, do you see a solution for this in the near middle distant future?
Well, there's a huge amount of investment required. Electrification, which the government are now coming round to after decades of saying that it wasn't a very good idea, it looks as if we will have a programme of rolling electrification, but we need to reopen more lines. We need to reopen hundreds of miles of line, and we need to redouble single lines, and we need to do it now. During the recession, we should be investing in the railways.
Now, what about the bus network? Because certainly the perception is in Bristol that the bus network is not the best in the world, or certainly not the best in the country. And, of course, without a decent bus network, everyone will be using far more their car. You know, if the bus network's not reliable, people need to buy a car.
Mm. Well, Bristol is an absolute classic case, isn't it? Public transport has decayed. The local railway lines are not seriously operated as a network around Bristol at all. It's almost an American-style city in the way that the railways deteriorated around Bristol, leaving lots of buses, relatively expensive buses, and buses trapped on overcrowded roads and caught up in the congestion that results. Bristol desperately needs trams, and it desperately needs a proper suburban railway system.
Yeah, is that a realistic possibility, do you think?
Well, it would be realistic if we lived in Germany, most other countries in Europe. But in Britain, with the politicians we have and with the sort of... No, I don't think it's realistic. I'm beginning to think I won't see any of these things in my lifetime, which is very sad.
Well, some other cities around the country, such as Manchester and Nottingham, have had trams. Why do you think Bristol hasn't?
Well, it comes down to not having enough political will in the city. Other cities have pushed harder, but plenty of cities like Bristol have had very viable schemes that have been knocked back by government. So the government has to say, OK, we're going to allow 20 next year. 20 city schemes. That's what's needed, and Bristol would be one of them. And a lot of the land is safeguarded. Most of the routes have been decided. It would be relatively easy to get it going quite quickly.
Transport writer David Henshaw there, speaking to me earlier. Hang on, no, that wasn't. That was, yes it was. His magazine is called A to B, as he mentioned briefly there, and that magazine, A to B on the net, is at a website called www.atob.org.uk. That's A to B, with the letters T-O for two, A2B.org.uk. And his book on beaching and rail privatisation, it's called The Great Railway Conspiracy. Anyway, I'm joined again by Martin Summers. Martin, why is it so much more expensive to get a train to London than it was before privatisation?
Well, I mean, a lot of the reasons have just been explained by your previous contributor, which there's not a lot to add. The idea that privatisation and competition would reduce fares has been shown to be a complete fallacy. As one of the people who was asked about the services in the city in the earlier piece was saying, it's first bus in Bristol is a monopoly. It's a private monopoly, so obviously they run the whole thing to try and maximise their profit take.
So what's the essential difference? I mean, we used to have something called the Bristol Omnibus Company, and now it's First Bus. What's the essential difference between
the two? The essential difference is as your contributor pointed out, at privatisation, the railways absorbed about £1 billion of public subsidy every year. Now, the railways absorb £7 billion of public subsidy. So, in a sense, although we say we've got a private sector railway, in fact, we haven't. We've just got a more expensive public sector railway. Just the same thing has happened in the financial markets. We put government money into the financial markets, and they say, oh, look, what a big private financial market we've got. But, of course, it isn't private. If it's ultimately dependent upon public subsidy, then it isn't private. First Bus isn't really private, but what we've actually done is we've put middlemen into the system to take off a profit, and therefore it's less efficient than it was previously. And you've got to remember that public transport, especially in cities, is usually subsidised because there are external costs and benefits of having a good public transport system. If you try and run the public transport system at a profit, you're likely to shrink it away to virtually nothing, which means that you end up with a private system with everybody in their cars, which of course is subsidised in its own way. The roads are built by the government, etc. So, of course, in the 50s and the 60s, the tradition was to have some kind of overall plan, some kind of idea of where you were going. It all sounded very quaint, that very first piece that you had, going back to the 50s, it's kind of the tone of voice that they're using and so on. But of course, that was the stage at which the idea of planning gradually fell out of popularity, and we were all seduced by the idea that we were all going to sit in our cars and zoom from A to B, like in those old adverts from the 60s. But of course, that's turned into what it's turned into, which is, you know, grinding around the ring road as many of our listeners probably are at this moment.
So, what do you think the big oil companies play a part in all this?
Yes, I mean, obviously, it was in their interest to move towards car production rather than trains as a means of getting round. What's really paradoxical at the moment, of course, is that all over the world, including in Britain, we're now talking about giving money to car companies, basically nationalising GM, Chrysler, Jaguar. The whole list of the top car companies are all probably going to end up in public ownership or going to bankruptcy. Meanwhile, we've got private sector railways, which ought to be public sector. And this is an opportunity, of course, to rejig everything if we wanted to seize it as an opportunity. But for all kinds of inertial reasons, we probably won't, at least in the short run.
Okay, thanks, Martin. That's our economics correspondent and political expert of sorts, Martin Summers there, and he'll be back next week. Now, I did say we'd have a bit of nostalgia today, and here is a report on one of Somerset's preserved steam railway lines, made possible by the beaching cuts in the 60s, ironically, because this piece of line was left empty there, and now it's thriving. This is the East Somerset Railway, which is based in Cranmore, just east of Shepton Mallet.
I'm Dick Masters, I'm the railway's chairman.
Okay, Dick, can you tell us why you got involved with this place?
Originally, because my son, he joined just before I did, and that's back in 1992, and after coming and collecting him and so on, this was when he was 12 years old, about a year later I decided I'd like to join, and I've been here ever since.
So what is it, the attraction for you for steam trains? Obviously it's a nice place to take the kids out of a weekend, but for you personally?
Well, originally I joined because I liked working in the engine shed, and I had aspirations to get on the footplate, which I duly did, and that's still the biggest attraction. There's no doubt. There's no more satisfaction, I don't think. Nothing more satisfactory than driving the engine. That really is a pleasant thing to do, particularly when the place is packed with people, as it will be in a couple of weeks' time when we have Thomas here. So that for me is by far the most satisfying thing.
So you have some weekends where you have special things going on. Can you tell us about one or two of those? You just mentioned Thomas. What else?
Yes, well, I mean, like today, for example, we've got a lunchtime wine and dine train, which has been very busy, and we run those about once a month, and we also do murder mysteries in the evening. We've got one on May the 16th, I think it is, and another one in June, another one in July, as well as Thomas coming. We've got in June the 6th, I think it is, we've got a cider and cheese event, which we ran for the first time last year, and that was very popular. And, of course, in the summer, again, we have Thomas here in August, and we have an August bank holiday event. And probably the busiest time of the year is December, when we have our Santa specials, and we are packed with people for about a month then.
Now, we're standing here in the signal box. Is this just for show, or does it actually work, and are you doing things on the line here?
At the moment, the levers are not connected, but if you can see out the window, you can see all the signals are there in place, and various bits of rodding equipment and so on are going in. And the plan, ultimately, is to be able to operate all the signals and the points at Cranmore from this box. So it will become a fully operational box.
So is it a bit hazardous at the moment without having the proper signals going up and down and stuff for the drivers?
No. We have a system of working at the moment which involves effectively one engine in steam, and the driver holds the token, which is his permission to be on the railway, and the token also includes a lock, a key, to undo the point locks, which are there's one at the end of the loop just up there, and only he is able to unlock that lock and allow his engine to pass.
So it's nice to hear that there is actually quite safe, even without the signal box.
Oh, absolutely. It has to be safe. We have a safety case which is approved by the railway inspectorate. In fact, every railway that operates and carries passengers has to have an approved safety case, and we've had that for many years. Now, what about the history of this line? Because I imagine it was closed down in the 1960s with the beaching cuts, was it? And whereabouts does it run from and to?
Yes, that's right. It was closed to passenger traffic in the 60s. There was freight traffic because tar came in to the sidings here, and that was used for making asphalt at the nearby quarries, and that carried on till 1985. At that time, though, BR pulled out altogether. We then moved into Cranmore Station and started to operate our trains. Well, we'd been running trains here from about 1975 to 1985, just running from Cranmore West for about a mile down the line. But from 1985, we were able to run trains from Cranmore Station, and we extended the line at that time as well, all the way down to Mendip Vale. So we have a 2 mile running track, and that's how we operate today.
Now, is there any hope, do you think, that one day trains from here will be able to join up with trains from the proper BR network, or whatever it is called these days?
The national network. I think it's that's something really for the distant future, the possibility of running through trains. I mean, we are connected to the national network, and from time to time trains, special trains, do come in. But actually running any sort of public service from here onto the national network, that's a much bigger thing. I don't know whether that would come about, but certainly we like having that connection. It does mean that we're able to bring specials in on for special events and so on. Large steam engines from running rail trips perhaps from London will call in here, and it's very nice to see them.
Now, you're running almost entirely on public contributions and voluntary labour. Do you think it's really sustainable? Are you going to keep going? It's almost like it seems like it might be a bit of a fragile operation.
It's certainly quite a challenge today, keeping the railway's head above water financially. But yes, we do have we do survive on the basis of the fare income from the public, and on the basis of volunteers giving their labour freely. But the fact is, we are surviving. We're doing reasonably well. We made a little bit of a profit last year, which was very, very pleasant. And we're working hard this year to try to increase our passenger numbers. That's most important to us, even in this time of credit crunches and so on. We think we can offer people some good entertainment. That's why we're expanding the attractions here. We've got a miniature railway which exceeds from just outside, which is newly installed this year and ran for the first time over the Easter weekend. So yes, it is a viable operation. We do urgently need to, as I say, increase our passenger numbers more than anything else, I would say, and that will help us to keep up with all the constant demand for maintenance of the stock, of the engines, of the buildings, of the track, and everything else around here. By having more people, that gives us a little bit more money to play with, and will enable us to keep the railway in better shape.
My name's Grant Bolton. As well as steam raising working on the cook plate, I also help restore wagons and anything else that happens to come my way.
Okay, so what does that actually entail, working on the wagons? Because that seems like quite a big job.
It is a bit. I think I've got a 16-year plan at the moment, which is to restore all of them at rate of about 3 years. What it entails depends on the wagon, is just trying to get them back to the condition they were in the 1950s, when they were new.
So what sort of condition do you get these old wagons in, and how are they inspected by some sort of central government thing before they're allowed to run on here?
Not unless they carry passengers. Obviously they have to pass various safety critical tests, which is down to Her Majesty's Railway. We follow the codes there. The general idea is that they can come to us in any condition, and to try and get back into original condition. They can be metal tankers, they can be wood wagons with wood floors, they can be guards vans. Generally you get rotten wood, lot of rust in them, and it's to inspect them, take all the bad stuff away, put the good new stuff in, and make sure that they're all right.
So what about the other stuff you do here? How long have you been part of the railway?
Probably about 3 or so years now. I started off December, and they were putting in a footpath up at the far end of the line, And so I spent the first 3 months putting in fence posts, which is not exactly what you expect, but it got me meeting lots of people, and we all had a nice cup of tea around in the guards van, and just generally showed an interest from there on.
What's the attraction to you of these restored railways?
I love the atmosphere, the smell when you come in, the sulphur and the steam, it's wonderful. The people are friendly, the people are great, and just to see the smile on everybody's face when you're up here is it's worth it just to see that. At the moment, I'm restoring a creosote tank. Believe it or not, it's the last one in existence of its type, owned by somebody on the railway. The idea is to get that back up to how it was. However, the next project is up for debate, because I'm launching an appeal to help raise funds to replank one of our PMVs. Now, the wood for that alone is going to cost...
Hang on, what's that?
A PMV, sorry. We have fast fruits, which are passenger-carrying... fruit vehicles. They would carry strawberries on the old strawberry line, which is what this place was. PMVs for carrying luggage and the such, as far as I'm aware, anyway. Don't get me right on that. I may do wagons, I don't know much about them. The idea is to replank one of our wagons... but the timber alone for that is going to cost about £3,000 of raw materials. So the next project will depend on the public. I'll be launching a donation form. For every penny donated, you get a vote towards the wagon that you want. It'll be a choice of three.
My name's Cathy Clark. And I came here in the 1980s and replied to an advert in the local paper. They wanted somebody to sell David Shepherd prints and work in the art gallery, which was then in the signal box, which I did, and I've been here ever since.
Now, you must have seen a few changes over that time.
Well, there's lots of changes. You know, this building, in fact, was opened in 1991, I think, and this was Wells Goodshed. All these lovely timber and the stonework, the windows and everything came from Wells Goodshed and Westbury Submendit Station House.
This is a building that wasn't originally here. It has been kind of transported from other parts of the railway.
The volunteers, the people that work on the line, they sort of numbered all the stones, and then it was redesigned as this building, which is great. You know, it's lovely. Before, the signal box was in the gallery was in the signal box. And the little shop was in the old sort of Brunel building. And the little restaurant, the cafe type thing, was also up there as well. So it was quite small when we started with all those people that used to come here.
My name's Steve Masters. I'm driving today. I've been a driver since I was 21, which was 8 years ago now. And I started working here when I was about 11, I believe. as well as driving, I also run the workshops. So I'm responsible for all the rolling stock and also the maintenance and the overhauls of the steam locos.
Now, I've noticed we just come out of the workshops, and it almost looks as busy as it was in its heyday, because there's probably, I'd say, about 6, 7, 8 people there, all with stuff to do today. Now, this is all done on voluntary labour, but what do you actually do in there?
It's more a question of what we don't do now. I mean, the volunteer labour is very valuable to us, so anything we can do ourselves saves us a huge amount of money, and it's only the very skilled jobs, such as the largest machining jobs, and other things like that, perhaps the welding, that we would actually contract out. So in that respect, we try to do as much as possible.
Now, we're sitting in the cab of a steam engine here. Can you tell us a bit about this particular one?
This loco is a copy of the American engines that were built during the war. They were known as Yankee tanks, and they came across to this country during the war as a cheap loco, and they actually ran on the southern region, especially around Southampton Docks.
So how much can you actually keep working and keep maintained in that shed of yours?
We can maintain just about as much as we use, so we couldn't really take on much more with our staff resources and just the space, really. We're able to maintain our own fleet for the size of line that we've got.
Now, one of the particular things you do down here, I've noticed, is this thing every once in a while, I think is it every few weeks, you do a driver for a fiver. It probably is one of the cheapest places in the country for someone to actually get a bit of experience on the footplate of a working steam engine. Can you just run us through, you know, is it a really complicated thing to drive one of these things?
No, what we do our driver for a fiver scheme, as you say, because it's fairly affordable. You don't need to book before you come along. It's generally on the busier weekends or the bank holidays or any events that you can find out on our website or in the leaflet. And it really is a case of you turn up and there'll be a queue of people waiting to, you know, achieve their lifetime ambition, and they have a little drive of one of our smaller engines. And we actually use Lady Nan, which is it's a very small shunting engine. The controls are nice and light, so it's very responsive, and you know it really is a case of one thing at a time. The driver's obviously with you all the time. It's actually simpler than driving a car the first time. There's no balancing clutches and accelerators. It literally is let the brake off, then open the regulator, and it will start to move.
Okay, brakes and regulators. In a car, you've got your accelerator, clutch and brake, and steering wheel. Obviously, there's no steering wheel on one of these. But what are the main controls?
To compare it to a car, the brakes obviously are very important. We've got several brakes. We've got a handbrake in the same way as a car, which is like a parking brake. And that's literally a mechanical screw, and that applies the pressure to the brake to the wheels of the brake blocks. And then we've on the loco we've got a steam brake and also a vacuum brake, which is used for controlling the train. Instead of an accelerator, we've got a regulator valve, which just lets the steam from the boiler through to the cylinders. And instead of a gearbox and a gear stick, we've got a reverser. So although we don't have gears as such, we do control the direction in which the local will work using a reverser. So very basically, that's what the driver's got to play with. But it's probably more complicated is all the controls that the fireman's got to deal with, because he's got to control the fire, the water, the boiler pressure. So that's really what your carburetor does on your car automatically for you, and it's there at an instant. Whereas with an old steam engine like this, you need to know a little bit in advance what you want, so that your fireman can get the engine ready to do what it needs to. The line originally used to run from Whittam Fiery between Bruton and Froome, and it went up through Cranmore, which is where we are now, through to Shepton Mallet, then Wells, and eventually it went up to Yatton, which is back onto the main line between Bristol and Exeter. We currently operate from Cranmore to just outside Shepton Mallet, so it's a couple of miles of that original section. Although we don't operate over it, we do have trains that come in still from the main line, because the line is still connected down to Whittam Friary, which is known as East Somerset Junction now. And there's also Tor Works, which is the quarry just down at Mearhead, which use the line on a daily basis. So that's literally a half a mile around the corner from where we stop running.
Driving one of these trains would be fine in the winter time, because you've got that nice fire there keeping you warm. But it must be hellish in the summer. You must get really hot. You've got your boiler suit on and everything.
Yeah. In fact, no matter what time of the year, it's not a case of taking your jacket off. Your jacket's there to keep the heat off you from the fire. Because certainly, if you're on the shovel firing, you want as much protection on your arms as you can. But yeah, it very much depends on the engine. This particular engine is very hot. It's the cab is fairly enclosed. You're very close to the fire, and you don't really have the nice drafts coming through the cab on a nice open back tender engine, which does keep you cool. But at the same time, it keeps you dry. So.
Okay, so further details of what's going on down there in Cranmore can be found on the internet at www.eastsomersetrailway.com, and their phone number is 01749 880 417. That's eastsomersetrailway.com, and there are trains running all weekends throughout the summer and autumn, and specials on bank holidays, where, as Steve Masters was saying, you can have a go at driving a steam engine for the princely sum of £5. Now I'm joined by Colin Power, who will be telling us about his attempts as a layman to navigate his way through Britain's legal system.
Bristol, and welcome to another
episode of The Legal Minefield. Yes, yes, it's that time again of the week. Now, those people who've been following the show, as we've been sort of slowly progressing our way through this sort of minefield of information, just like to remind everyone that, you know, we're not, well, we're just men, really, aren't we?
This is in no way at all legal advice.
That's right, yes. We're just, you know, just a couple of men, just doing our thing, trying to work it all out. So, yeah, basically, we did talk, didn't we? You weren't there, Carl, but I was actually, on the first show, I was talking about the corporation, you know, that government thing.
Yeah, I know that government thing.
Yeah, so have you had a had a check on the website, have you? And
yeah, Dun & Bradstreet, you can find the UK there. It's a corporation, all right, and you're an employee of that corporation by definition of your state-given title, such as Mr. and your national insurance number.
That's right, yeah, and in fact, we covered that last week with some of the letters that we've been sending out to the Attorney General and people like that about the person and things like that. It's interesting, actually. Maybe we should just clarify for those people who missed it that, you know, you could look at it like this, I suppose, is that you have a person, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, you're not a person. You're either a man or a woman, but you have a person. And that person is your name in all uppercase letters with your state-given title, such as Mr. or Mrs. in front of it. If you take a look at any bill that comes to the post to you, your bank account, any of those things, you'll always see it's always the state-given title and all capital. That's your person or your straw man, as it's sometimes known.
That's right. For legal business, they call it like a legal entity, don't they, sometimes?
Yeah, well, it's a corporation, too. That's your corporation to do business with other corporations. So, like you say, you know, you're not a person. You have a person.
That's right. So, so we've actually been sort of, you know, fumbling around trying this out a couple of times and looking at sort of like, you know, and we actually found ourselves in a courtroom this morning, actually, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
It was quite an interesting experience. You know, went down there sort of thing to just sort of see what was going on and try and, you know, help them out a little bit. And well, what do you think happened today?
Well, I think it's only fair to warn the listeners that if you talk to most people about this, especially people in authority who are trying to get one over on you, they will look at you like you are completely insane.
Yeah, well, I looked at him like he was completely insane, but he was looking at me like, yeah. But there you go.
What they're trying to do there, they're trying to create joinder between you, the living man or woman, and the person. So it's all about contracts, basically. As soon as they say Mr. So-and-so and you say yes, bang, got you straight away.
Yeah, that's right. And it's quite funny because the first question, I think there was only two questions really asked, wasn't there? The first question was, are you Mr. blah, blah, blah? To which, you know, obviously...
you replied, no.
Well, I didn't say no, I'm not. I said I'm the authorised representative because, you know, that's what we are. We all are authorised to represent our own fictions.
I can't see anyone more appropriate to represent your own fiction than the man behind it.
That's it. So so basically, there we were. We sort of like... I did have a notarised sort of power of attorney sort of thing with me. Actually, for those who don't know, power of attorney actually should lawfully give you the right to speak from the court floor on behalf of a legal fiction. I think there's something to do with, like, a problem, isn't there, with legal fictions, actually, or, so to say, the court dealing with real men or something like that?
Well, the court can't really deal with real men, especially at magistrates' level, which is why they get their knickers in a twist and they scream and shout at you a lot when you try and keep the man and the person separated. They don't like it one bit and they really try and force the Mr. issue upon you and, you know, use the fear tactic of shouting and screaming. And
that's right, yeah. So after that, basically... yeah, we got past that stage anyway. You know, he sort of did accept the sort of power of attorney thing. And then what did he do after that? He sort of said, why is he not there?
Yeah, once they kind of and ahed and they all huddled together and realised that they couldn't really do anything against this fiction, so they decided to arrest the vessel, or straw man, as it were, the fiction, as he wasn't there to represent himself. That's how they tried to get round it, but... they're only prolonging what's inevitable.
Yeah, so we'll keep you posted on that. Let's have a bit of music now. Now it's a little song actually, that I wrote actually about some of this stuff. So it's a little bit of an original. And let's see if we can just bring that up for you now.
Fine, I'll go and play. You define, make it right.
Yes, that's a little bit of extra there for some music we've been putting out. Yeah, do check it out on the MySpace, Colin Power Mute Funk, I think. Colin Power Funk, I don't know, actually, you know, somewhere like that on some sort of MySpace thing. I don't really pay too much attention to this stuff. Just quickly, a quick plug for those who are interested. Go to tpuc.org. Do check out, we've got John Harris coming to Bristol. He is a free man, basically, who has... submit an affidavit to the Queen, who will be turning up at the Trinity Centre this Thursday.
And if you're on Facebook and you'd like to know more, then do a group search for the Freeman Society and you'll find a whole host of information there.
We've got time quickly. Yeah, just quickly about the birth certificate. Next week maybe we'll have a proper chat about, you know, birth certificates and things like that and what they're all about. So do stay tuned. And until the meantime, that's us for the Legal Minefield from this week. Remember, there's a caveat here. It's not legal advice. We're just trying to work it out as much as anyone else. We're just men, just doing our thing, human beings. No artificial fiction here. Do you know what I mean? It's just a man doing his thing. And that's all for me, Colin Power.
And I'm Carl Saxon.
And we'll see you again soon. Okay, so that's all for this week's show. Thanks to Quentin Marceron and Marina Morris as our reporters, and to Martin Summers, our political pundit. I'm Tony Gosling, and I'll be back again at 5 next Friday, where we'll be looking at the 7/7 London bombings, 4 years on. So, anyway, don't let the bankers get you down, and have a lovely, relaxing weekend. See you next Friday. Thank you.